Well, our subject is prayer, and over 50 years ago, a man named S.D. Gordon wrote, "The great people of the earth today are the people who pray." I do not mean those who talk about prayer. You know where that puts me this morning. Nor those who say they believe in prayer, nor yet those who can explain about prayer. I mean those people who take time and pray. And this morning, we want to talk about that business of taking time to pray. I don't suppose that there's any topic that produces more of an immediate sense of guilt with people than when you talk about their prayer life. You ask someone, "Well, how's it going?" "Well, not as well as it should." "Well, what does that mean?" "Well, I ought to be praying more than I do." "Well, how much are you praying?" "Well, not as much as I should." And so it goes. And because we don't really want to come to grips with it, and it is kind of fuzzy. We're not really sure about it. But there seems to be a genuine consensus that prayerlessness marks this generation. In fact, as a young Christian 27 years ago, even then, I was surprised that when I went to a prayer meeting, what was labeled as a prayer meeting, it was more of another message. And I had done some reading about what prayer meetings of the past were, where the people of God met to pray. And I remember a pastor I met who obviously was a man of prayer. And so, and he spoke on prayer, and I said, "Would it be possible, in your message you pointed out that the way to learn to pray, one of the ways is to pray with people who pray. May I pray with you?" He said, "Well, I'm too busy." But he said, "I do have a meeting with some pastors weekly, and if you'd like to join me, you may." And so I did, but I only went once because I knew he knew how to pray. But it seems that those men were not praying for the kinds of things that I really wanted to learn about. They were praying, but they weren't moving in the direction that I wanted to learn. I think of it sometimes as a tremendous inheritance that a parent may lay up for a child. And so when the child comes to adulthood, he may either squander all that inheritance and not only spend the interest, but spend all the capital till there's nothing left. And I sometimes feel that this generation has squandered the inheritance of the generations of the past who laid up for us a wealth of prayer. And I've taken that to heart for myself. If I leave my children nothing else, I want to leave them a huge inheritance of laid up prayer, interceding in their behalf. And so day by day, I try to put stuff in the bank of heaven that they'll be able to draw on in the future. I think another problem with our view of prayer and what hinders, what creates a problem is that it's another item on our do list. And we already have so much on our do list that to try to add one more thing tends to overwhelm us. And it's, how can I get all these things done today? But I would suggest to you that prayer is an atmosphere. Prayer is a climate. Prayer is a spirit of life. It's not a segment of life. It's not an aid to life, but a character of life. It is a way of life. So, Dr. Dick Helverson spoke to some of us last fall, and he said it's interesting that Christianity started in Israel as a relationship. It moved to Rome, where it became an organization, an institution. And then it went on to Europe, where it became a culture. And it came to the United States, and we made it an enterprise. And if there's anything we need to recapture, it's the idea that the Christian life is a relationship. And that puts us back to the sense that prayer is a way of life. It's not a segment of life. It's not something I add to life. Let me help you with where I'm going today. I want to talk about some of the hindrances that I sense this generation, our generation, faces. Some possible, a couple of correctives in our thinking that would help us to view things a little bit differently and hopefully affect some of the things that are hindering us. And then finally, some practical suggestions. So I want us to look first at, just very briefly, at hindrances. And if it helps you to have all one letter starting for memory, fine. I'm going to talk about sight, sloth, shallowness, and stereotypes that are hindrances to prayer. So in the area of sight, what I mean is we are an outward motivated generation. We are external in our seeking for gratification. We tend to be functional in our view of life, in our view of one another, in our view of ourselves. And what I mean by that is that we are directed or turned toward the outside, away from a center. We tend to relate to the body or to appearances rather than to the mind or to the inner life. The motivation arises from outside us. And by what I mean by functional is simply that a functional concept is that something is designed or developed chiefly from the point of view of use. And or someone who is able to perform a particular regular function. So you see it in the advertising. Do you know why I love my wife? If I believe the advertising, she makes great coffee. Or she gets ring around the collar out of my shirts. Or whatever. She's defined as a functional being, not as a person, by the media. And so we evaluate our days in terms of our usefulness, what we've achieved or done. We don't evaluate in terms of relationships. So when we meet one another, we say, what do you do? Because that's your sense of worth. Now, in Latin America, when they meet someone, they say, you give your whole name and they say, oh, now I know your family. I know who you are. They define one another in terms of their relationship by family. But in our culture, we tend to define one another in terms of what we do. We tend to define ourselves, and that becomes a hindrance. The factory has become our worldview. And while this outlook on life is giving way to information technology so that we think of people as highly sophisticated computers, the basic view of people as machines remains. Life is technological. Life is functional. This bit of time for this particular purpose, and if we cannot specify results from that particular use of time, we consider it wasted. Our view of child rearing becomes a program. If we can program the right inputs into our children, we will be assured of a properly functioning individual. If the inputs fail to produce results, then we need to reprogram our child to respond to those inputs correctly. Because obviously, if we do all the right things, then this child is going to respond in all the right ways. Because we have this functional, technological, machinery view of people and life. And so we come to God. I have 15 minutes to receive your input and give you mine. In that time, the results must take place. If they don't, I obviously have not pushed the proper buttons, or there's something wrong with God. And if I continue my 15-minute segments without results, then I assume that God is not there, or that God doesn't care about me, or somehow I can't be the Christian I'm supposed to be. The formula has not worked, so I give up. And I still view life functionally, God functionally, my Christian life functionally. And prayerlessness marks a generation that thinks that way. So we live by sight. We want immediate results, the outward stimulus that will produce continuing action. What do I mean by sloth? Well, I mean moral sloth. The desert fathers, those who were kind of founders in the movement of the monasticism, labeled busyness as moral sloth. We know what is really important, but we also wish to avoid the hard things in life. And so we provide ourselves with handy excuses by filling our lives with activity. And much of that activity wears the cloak of ministry. And so someone wrote a book about active men, passive husbands, or I forget the title exactly. But the idea was men who are aggressive and successful in their work, who come home and are absolute failures because they will not face the hard things at home, and so they devote themselves to the things at the office where they know they can function well. And as I look at this generation, I think of the busyness of noise, radio, tapes, video, anything to crowd out thought. And all of it can be Christian. We listen to the Christian radio station or Christian tapes going to and from work. We turn on the Christian station or something or music when we get home. And it's because we are frightened to be alone and to be quiet. And Holly, when you shared that this morning, I was just stunned because you are saying what we need to hear. When finally everything went still, Holly heard the voice of God. Are we afraid to hear it? Is that why we crowd our lives with so much noise and busyness? Because we really don't want to face Him? Well, that's one of the great values of coming to Glen Eyrie. It's a place where we can be silent if we will. And we want to avoid filling this place with the accoutrements of life, the TVs, the radios, the special recreation things that keep you active. Because I've had more people who have visited here for the first time and they say there's something different about this place. There's an atmosphere, a quietness. There's peace. That's right. When you think of all the prayers and praises that these rocks have absorbed around here, if they could speak, they would just resound with the glory of God in all that they've heard. But it comes from that still time. And when I was here 20 years ago as a trainee, most nights I would take long walks just to hear what God might want to say to me. And we need that. Sloth can be cloaked in busyness. And then we tend to be shallow. And what I mean by shallow is shallow in our relationships. Our relationships with one another reflect our relationship with God and vice versa. It's a vicious circle that compounds our problem of relating deeply and well. We substitute words for deeds. I appreciate much that has come from the Jesus people and all the charismatic emphasis that came from that. But one thing I've never become comfortable with is telling people, being in a circle and saying, I love you. That's as empty to me as anything that could happen. For me to actually serve you in some way, to demonstrate patience, to hear your hurts with understanding and to pray with you. To me, that's saying I love you. But to say it when I don't even know you is almost nonsense to me. But this generation wants to substitute words for real actions, for deeds. And we confuse feelings with genuine care. I don't like someone. When I'm around them, I feel uncomfortable. Therefore, I sense that I don't love them. But if I demonstrate to them real patience, if I demonstrate to them care about their cares, if I assist them in some way in an area they need assistance, I'm loving them. I have a retarded brother. Don has lived with us several times. And just recently, he's been with us for about a year and just now moved out into an apartment. But I wish my wife could share with you some of the things she's learned. Don can be exasperating at times. He's an adult. He looks older than I do. And yet he's about a five-year-old in many ways. And so you want to treat him as an adult, and you start that in some areas, and you get back child. And it's so exasperating that it's easy to lose patience. So we operate comfortably in functional areas where we can talk business, whether it's job or family or church, what we do. But we become extremely uncomfortable in relating to one another as distinct individuals with personal aspirations, foibles, and disappointments. To just get to know you for who you are. See, it's interesting. Now, women don't have this problem, but men do. Whenever I've gone into a ministry where I'm visiting it and trying to evaluate and help the staff, I'll sit down with all the key folks in that ministry, and my first question will be, tell me, what is God teaching you this day? Or how is your relationship with God? Do you know what the men will tell me? They'll start talking about their ministry, about how this guy or that guy is doing, about how they're frustrated or not frustrated in evangelism or whatever. And so I'll listen, and when they finish, I'll say, now tell me, what is God teaching you about himself? How are you and the Lord doing these days? And they'll tell me more about ministry. And I'll listen, and then when they're finished, I'll say, now tell me, how's it going with you and God these days? And they begin to get the point. Now, women respond to that right off, but men don't. But it is interesting when women get together that they will tend to talk about what they're doing with their children or whatever, and they're back in that rut of the activities instead of talking about how we really relate as people. Well, that's the shallowness, and I think it comes because we don't really know God. We know a lot of things about him, but we really don't know him. And then finally, there's a stereotype, and what I mean by that is our concepts and ideas of prayer may be formed more by what others have said, or especially by what we hear when others pray. I was talking with a fellow over the phone one day, and he was pouring out his heart. He was frustrated. He was angry with God. He felt that God did not care, was not listening to him. And after he finished, I said, have you told God this? You can't talk to God that way. I said, why not? He's heard everything you've said as we've been talking. I said, have you ever read the Psalms? Well, yes, but somehow he had a conception of what was acceptable in prayer that was preventing him from praying. And all of us have that. When I sit down to pray with a navigator, I know exactly what he's going to pray about, and I know how he's going to pray. I know the words he'll choose. I know the tone of voice. I know the things he'll emphasize. When I pray with a Baptist, it's the same way. When I pray with a Pentecostal, it's the same thing. And that we all have our little patterns. And without realizing it, we slip into the rites of the heathen, where we simply keep up vain repetitions and fail to pray. So we tend to stereotype. And then we really fail to know what we don't know about prayer. And that enhances or deepens our ruts. Well, what are some correctives to all this? Well, I'm going to suggest two, and I'd like you to turn with me to Isaiah chapter 30. One is learning to wait upon God, and the other is casting aside your idols. Isaiah chapter 30, 15 to 22. For thus says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest you shall be saved. In quietness and in trust shall be your strength. And you would not. But you said, no, we will speed upon horses. Therefore you shall speed away. And we will ride upon swift steeds. Therefore your pursuers shall be swift. 1,000 shall flee at the threat of one. At the threat of 5 you shall flee, till you are left like a flagstaff on the top of a mountain, like a signal on a hill. Therefore, the Lord waits to be gracious to you. Therefore, he exalts himself to show mercy to you. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him. Yea, O people in Zion who dwell at Jerusalem, you shall weep no more. He will surely be gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teacher will not hide himself any more. But your eyes shall see your teacher. And your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, when you turn to the right or when you turn to the left. Then you will defile your silver-covered graven images and your gold-plated molten images. You will scatter them as unclean things. You will say to them, be gone. Seems to me the two things he's telling us in here, one is wait upon him. In returning and rest, blessed are all those who wait for him. And then cast aside your idols. A.W. Tozer said something like this, what comes to mind when we think of God is the most important thing about us. Whatever concept you have of God dictates to you how you live life, how you relate to others, how you relate to God. And as I've looked at this generation and all the material on burnout and all this, the business of stress, I've decided it's because we haven't learned how to be still and know that He is God. We are trying to be gods ourselves, and we're destroying ourselves. We really do not understand the gospel because we do not understand the grace of God. To us, the gospel is a message that applied someday back there when I said, Lord, save me. And that's where it ended. And we have no conception at all of what the gospel really is. And so we know nothing of the grace of God. And this generation of evangelicals is characterized by a generation frantically running after God, frantically doing very much living by works, though we would never, never, never say that. For we do not believe it, but we do because that's the way we live. And we are convinced that the more we can do for God, the more spiritual, the more victorious, the more successful we will be. And we measure success by all the outward trappings of the factory scheme of production, which is foreign to this book and to the God who made us. So, what I'd like to say here is that it's more than an intellectual groping after God. Now, I've memorized lots of passages about God. I've got the names of God memorized. I look for passages that reveal in a special way one of those names, and so that I understand more of what it reveals of God. But knowing that doesn't mean I know God. Jim Downing, who's one of the original navigators and has had great influence in my life, was talking about Christian maturity one day, and he said, has it ever struck you as odd why some believer a year or two old can be so much more mature than someone who's known the Lord for 20 years? He said, what is it that makes the difference? Well, it's that that believer of a year or two has been so responsive to God that God has led that person into experiences of God, in the experience of answered prayer, and an experience of faith where out of great fear and trembling, he took a step in obedience to what he thought God wanted, not knowing what was out there, and took that step, and God came in and showed his power and glory and might and mercy and grace. And so this person has experiences with God. And there's all the difference in the world between that and the one who can give all the right answers about God. And so I've had to pray, Lord, not just the mind. Neither do I exercise myself in matters too great for me. That was my problem. What I need, Lord, is just to experience you in my day-to-day living. So I need to know his name in terms of experience. In Ephesians 3, that's what Paul is praying. That you may really come to know, practically, through experience for yourselves, the love of Christ, which far surpasses mere knowledge without experience, it says in the Amplified. That you may become a person wholly filled and flooded with God himself. He says, I want you to so enter into the experience of the love of God in life that when people touch you, they meet God. And then casting aside our idols, casting aside our comprehension of our assumption that we know God and we know the gospel, and casting aside our will. I just finished teaching the book of Esther in our adult Sunday school class, and if you know the book of Esther, you know that Haman was the villain of the book who set out to destroy the Jews. And as we studied Haman in chapter 3, verse 7 says that he sat down and cast pur, the lot, to discover when would be the right day and the right hour, the right time to strike against the Jews. And I asked people, now tell me, what do you learn about Haman as a religious man? Well, it's clear to me that he was religious. Not only that, he had absolute faith. He believed in his religion because he was directing his life according, his decisions and his life according to what came out of this religious practice he was involved in. So I said, other than the fact that a Christian believes in the true God and he believed in some other God, what is different? What would characterize him as different from a true Christian? Well, it took us a long time to figure that out. I'll tell you the characteristic of a pagan prayer. Lord, do my will. Just show me when. Bless my plans. here is what I propose to do. Now you tell me when is the right time for the maximum blessing on this. And there are a lot of Christians who pray as Christian pagans. We need to set aside our will. Dr. Houston said we project into the heavens the aspirations of our own will. A year ago, well, more than that, I was asked to relocate here in Colorado and take up a new job, and I felt that's what God wanted. It meant we had to sell a house. Well, in Seattle, it was not a very good time to sell a house. So obviously, since God was leading me to come out here, it was obviously His will, right, to sell my house? Wrong. In fact, I had seen others struggle with this, and very close friends in our church. And so I got alone with the Lord, and I said, Lord, I'm not going to assume anything here. I don't know what kind of statement you want to make through our experience about yourself, to us, and to others. But I want to give you absolute freedom. Take the house from us because we can't keep up the payments. Cause us to keep it so that we rent it, sell it, whatever needs to be done. That will be the greatest revelation of something of yourself to us and to others. Do that. That was scary. That was scary. But I did not want to assume that His will was that the house should sell. For all I knew, we may be kicked out of this job back there in another year. I had no idea what God was about. Well, it didn't sell. And I mean, we were in a bind. Financially, we were in a bind. And people were praying with us. And I was keeping a diary. And so I have a little group of people I keep up with in correspondence on how to pray for us. And I would send out little notes. Here's what I'm learning. Here's where we are. Finally, in March, I sent out a thing that said, SOS, help. I am strapped. We can go no further. Unless God intervenes, I don't know what will happen. And all I need to know is, what does God want me to do? And I don't seem to understand that. Well, I won't go into all the details, but all that God did, I have yet to be able to put together on paper. And how He revealed His power, His glory, His goodness, His grace, and taught me some things about self-centered praying versus praying in a way that's larger and more comprehensive. And finally, we need to cast aside our pretensions that we know how to pray. In the olden days, there were men who saw the face of God. Why don't they do that anymore? The young student asked the rabbi. And the rabbi thought for a minute and he said, perhaps because no one stoops so low anymore. And that might be our great problem. That we assume we know so much when we know so little. The first Bible study I did as a new believer was entitled Master Secrets of Prayer. One of the things I remember is that he said, probably none of us ever get out of the kindergarten of prayer. There are no PhDs in prayer, for which I am grateful. And year by year, I feel like I'm going backwards instead of forwards. I come to God again and again and say, oh God, I have no idea of how to pray. I don't think I've learned a thing. Would you teach me how to pray? In this situation, would you show me what's right? Would you reveal something of you in this that I may know how to approach you? Well, what are some, let's see, overhead projector helps. What are some practical suggestions that I could give us on praying? Well, I'll suggest four here. Build a habit. Use a prayer list. Practice the presence of God. And then evaluate what you ought to be praying and do that periodically. First, build a habit. In Genesis 19:27, it's a simple little verse, but we learned something significant about... Thank you. I've been criticized for that many times, girls, so thanks. Build a habit, use a prayer list, practice the presence of God, and evaluate what you pray. Okay? In Genesis 19:27, simple verse. Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord. Well, there's a couple of things that I see right off. Abraham got up, but I won't make much over that. What I will say is that to the place where he stood before the Lord. It's clear that Abraham had a time and a place where he met God. Now, I discovered as a pagan college student that there was one place I studied better than any other place, and that was at the desk in my room. So I only used the library when I had to. It was like when I sat down in that chair at that desk, everything clicked into place and I was ready to study. But when I went to other places, there were other distractions and somehow I wasn't in gear. Well, there's a little chair in our living room, and that is my current altar, my Bethel, my place with God. And our oldest son has been meeting with me. In fact, it's so thrilling. In September, the first day of school, Matt came up and asked if he could pray with me. And that has become our habit for this year. And it's growing and it's exciting. But I came up one day and he was in my chair at my altar. So I said, Matt, you sit over here. That's my chair. Because that's my current altar where each morning, when I sit, there's immediately everything's in place to meet God. The way you build a habit is to establish a time and place. Now, every time we move, I have to find a new Bethel, a new little altar, a place. And when I travel, I have to have something. I've worked out other systems. Susanna Wesley had a place. She had 19 children in 21 years. So, ladies, be encouraged. Now, I forget, I think nine or ten of those died. But in her household, things were so hectic. The kids knew when Mom put her apron over her face, she had just gone to her altar. You leave Mom alone. Now, we may have to do that. Hudson Taylor found that in some places, what he would have to do is walk to a corner, face it, and people knew that when Hudson Taylor had walked into that corner, that he had just entered into God's presence and he had to leave him alone. That was his way of shutting out all the stuff going on around him. So all I would say is build a habit, and it starts with a time and place. What's implied in this verse is just that thought. Abraham had a place where he went regularly at an appointed time to meet God. And then finally, use of a prayer list, or secondly, use of a prayer list. Now, I am a person who's a great plotter, highly disciplined, which I suppose is the nature of plotters. And so I get into ruts very quickly. So I use my prayer list, I develop a good prayer list, and then I get into it, and it's like I'm in a tunnel. And that kind of is what you pray. And day after day, I go through that list, and which is all right. Those are things I want to pray about. But yesterday, I got to the office, and it had been an interesting morning, but I hadn't had the kind of intercessory prayer time I wanted. And I suddenly realized that I'd left my prayer cards at home. What will I do? Well, I thought I could pray. So as I sat there and tried to review the basic areas that I wanted to pray, it's interesting that God said, oh, this is so good, Roger. You don't know this, but I planned this. You've been praying about this one area for months. And there's something I've wanted to say to you, but you've been so busy going down your prayer list, I haven't had time. And so I had to get up and go write on the board a little outline of three things, one area, but that dealt with three issues that God wanted to say to me about that. And then I could sit back and say, wow, well, let me pray about that, Lord. So all I would say is the value of a prayer list is it helps me pray for the things that I really ought to be praying about. But it can get in the way. And so it might be good if you use one to set it aside from time to time. Or perhaps even more helpful is as you're praying, just stop from time to time and say, now, Lord, is there anything you want to say to me about this person? And it's interesting. I was praying for some couples one day. In fact, Jim, it was you and your Bible study, that little group of folks. And I was praying for you all, and I sat back and said, Lord, is there anything I ought to be praying for these folks that I'm not? He said, you dummy. I wondered if you'd ever ask. And it was like I was missing a huge area of need in what I was praying for them. And I was oblivious to it until I said, God, do you want to say something to me? So use a prayer list, but don't let it become the law that forces you, you know, every day to cover just those things. Now, I use 4x6 cards, and I do that because I found it's the most portable system I've got, and it's very adjustable. I can throw away cards, I can add cards, and so on. And I have three colors. I have one color that I use, and that's things I want to pray about every day. And then I have another color that are things that are temporary, project things. This conference is one of those things that ends up on that prayer list. So I begin from the time I accept a speaking appointment until sometime maybe a month after the conference to pray over that. And then I chuck that little card. But it was just in there as a temporary card to remind me to pray for certain short-term projects. And then I have a stack of things that I really want to pray about, but I can't pray about them every day. It's too much. And so once I get through the other two colors, then if I take as much time as I have, and some days I don't even get to those cards because the time required to really pray in depth over some things have usurped that. But then I just rotate through those cards for whatever time I have in a day. I may go through 10 or a dozen or 15 in a day. I may get none in a day. But that gets me through the things that I really want to remember. Missionaries that I don't pray for daily, countries of the world, our nation, our church, by our church, I mean the evangelical church, and so on. Use of a prayer list can be very helpful. And then learning to practice the presence of God. Now, many of you have probably read that little booklet by Brother Lawrence, The Practice of the Presence of God. If you haven't, you should. It's very helpful. But probably the most helpful thing to me was to take the Word of God seriously. 1 Thessalonians 5:18 or 5:17 says, pray without ceasing. 18 says, and everything give thanks. Now, Lord, I don't know how to pray without ceasing. How do you do that? Well, he said, let's start with, and everything give thanks. Okay? I took that quite literally. I was in the army. I didn't like being in the army. I didn't like some things about being in the army. I knew I was there by God's appointment. So I thought, okay, Lord, I'll take that literally. And so when I went to the water fountain to get a drink, I thanked God for water. When I met with a friend or I was carrying out a job or I was doing my task for the company commander, I would thank God for that. Well, what it meant, what ended up happening, because I was thanking God for every little thing during the day, I was learning to pray without ceasing. I was entering in to the experience of the practice of the presence of God. And as situation by situation arose, I was learning to do that. And so I would say a simple little thing like give thanks in everything will help you to pray without ceasing, to practice the presence of God. Another thing that will help you is to do everything as to the Lord. Colossians 3:23. Now, the last thing on earth I wanted to be in the army was a Remington Raider, a clerk typist. That's what I was. And so I went into a unit where they just had a congressional investigation. So they'd done a complete topsy-turvy. They brought in new officers and everything. And so the new company commander decided, in order to get this unit where it needs to be, my standard is perfection. So when I typed, they didn't have Selectric 2s, you know, where you could have automatic correction. It was a mechanical, I forget what I had. But his standard was no erasers, no corrections. Well, so I saw some grimaces out there. Well, talk about learning to do all things as unto the Lord. I would sweat as I prayed over that typewriter. God, help me to get every letter right. And several times a day, I would carry that trash can out and empty it in the dumpster and come back in and start typing again to give him perfect copy on every piece that he required. Well, that was of God, that I might in one way begin to learn to experience His presence in all that was going on. Learn to do everything as unto Him. As you dress your child, pray that it be clothed in the righteousness of Christ. As you dress yourself, do the same. As you take a shower, think of the constant cleansing of the blood of Christ. And so on. Learn to do everything as to the Lord. And then what to pray? Well, there's so much we could pray for. It's overwhelming. I would suggest the thing that helped me most was figure out, God, for what have you made me responsible? Now, He's made me responsible for my family and my job. And then there's some concerns that relate to that. So the first thing I did, I took a new job. So I looked at my prayer list and I thought, Lord, who am I responsible for in this job? So I listed all the people that are related to that. I listed the concerns that relate to my job. And of course, I have my family. It's exciting. Very exciting. This summer, we have 5 teens in our house now. We have 3 children. My wife's brother is going through a divorce. And so his 2 boys have come to spend the summer with us. Well, I've been praying for them for at least 14 years because that's how old Frank is. And I began to pray for them from the time they were born. Well, I don't know what God is going to do, but wouldn't it be exciting if through all this upheaval in their home and our family and our struggle and tears over that, God would allow us to be the instruments to see those 2 boys meet the Savior this summer. Well, He's brought them to us, so we'll see. As 14 years of prayer may have some fruit. And then I want to pray for that for which I've been commanded to pray. The lost, for our governments, and for laborers. You know, when a year ago we took a rental house on the other side of town. We've just moved. And we met our neighbors. We had a little barbecue in the backyard and invited our neighbors in. And just to come over and have a good time and get acquainted. And I remember meeting Norm and his family, and I thought, his wife is very religious, doesn't appear to know the Lord. Norm appears to be antagonistic, somewhat atheistic even in his attitudes. And I wonder if we'll even get through to him at any time this year. Dean and his wife, I thought, she sounds like a believer. I bet she is. We confirm that later. But Dean, I wonder where that guy really is. He's at least interested because he's attending church. But I wonder where he is. Well, just before we moved a couple weeks ago, they had dinner over at Dean's home, and Dean and Barb. And after dinner, we came in the living room, sat around to chat. And do you know we could not get off the subject of spiritual things? I mean, we could not get off the subject. That's all they wanted to talk about. Norm, who a year ago seemed somewhat antagonistic and atheistic, said, you know, I've come to the conclusion that our problem is we complicate faith. We need to stay with the simplicity of believing in Christ. Dean, you've been going to church and Sunday school. What are you learning? What do you think it's all about? And he said, well, the goal of what we're after is just to stick with how to become intimate with Christ. Well, years worth of praying for this couple. Because that's what God told me to pray for. The lost. Those around me, our neighbors. And then pray the promises. I think people rob themselves by not praying over the Word. The reason it takes me so long to read the Bible every day is because I pray over it sentence by sentence. I pray about what God says there. Pray about it for me, for others, for whatever things He brings to my mind about it. And that leads me to pray the promises of God. The Navigators were founded on the promises of God. I have in my prayer list of cards, one of my daily things, is these 6 or 8 promises that God, that are foundational to the work of the Navigators. And every day, in praying for the work of the Navigators, I pray over the promises that God has given us. Lord, I don't know all that you intended by these, but would you do what you had in mind? Would you make us fruitful as you promised? Would you raise up laborers through us as you promised? Would you make us a holy people as you promised? And I pray those things for myself. I was thinking about how God had spoken to me from His Word and given me promises. And I thought, Lord, I've been a terrible steward of what you've given. I never even pray about those things. So now on my daily prayer list, the first thing I pray about when my name comes up is I take each of these promises and say, Lord, whatever you want to do with these, I just want to be faithful and available to what you have in mind through them. Well, helps build a habit, use a prayer list, practice the presence of God, and think through what we really ought to be praying under the direction of God.